Welcome to today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jim Mitchell, your volunteer broadcaster here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. These are the journal's business and finance headlines for Friday, April 3rd, 2026. The U.S. will impose tariffs of up to 100% on branded pharmaceuticals, the White House said, though nations or drug makers will be offered paths to reduce them subject to conditions. Major U.S. stock indices ended mixed after early weakness following Trump's primetime speech, with the S&P 500 and NASDAQ rising 1/10 and 2/10 of a percent, respectively, and the Dow falling 1/10 of a percent. Mortgage rates rose to the highest level since September in a fifth straight weekly increase that lifted the average 30-year fixed rate loan to 6.46%. OpenAI acquired TBPN, an online talk show that aims to compete with Bloomberg and CNBC in instant analysis of tech news and executive interviews. A vendetta between the founders of Two Sigma flared up last month, prompting a new leadership battle for their hedge fund firm. KKR closed a $23 billion fund focused on private equity investments in North America, its largest of the kind. Sachs Global secured $500 million in financing from key bondholders to support the retailer's planned exit from bankruptcy this summer. Publicis will acquire sports marketing agency 160 over 90 from talent firm WME, as sports have become essential to brands seeking extensive reach. And Bed Bath & Beyond agreed to acquire The Container Store and its brands Elfa and Closet Works in a deal valued at $150 million. So let's begin with a look at the markets and this article, Investors Waver After Trump Speech Ending Two-Day Rally, by Jared Mitovich. Wall Street on Thursday gave its verdict on President Trump's latest attempt to sell Americans on the war in Iran. Traders didn't love what they heard. In a Wednesday primetime address, the president said the U.S. would eventually end the war in Iran and that the Strait of Hormuz would open up naturally thereafter. But Trump also pledged to hit Iran extremely hard in the coming weeks, sending oil prices surging above $100 a barrel and unwinding a two-day Hormuz hope rally. The remarks failed to satisfy investors who hoped to hear a clear timeline to exit from the conflict and get 10 million barrels of oil a day flowing again through the Persian Gulf. Markets kind of took a step back and said, okay, maybe we're not on the off-ramp as much as we thought we were, said Brad Long, chief investment officer at Wealthspire. The major U.S. stock indices fell sharply on the opening bell before recovering most of those losses by midday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 0.1%, or 61.07 points, while the NASDAQ rose 0.2% and the S&P ticked up 0.1%. Friday's monthly jobs report will give an update on the state of the nation's labor market, but with U.S. stock markets closed for the Good Friday holiday, investors will have to wait to trade on the news. Seems like yet another weekend where there's just a lot up in the air, said Rod Thummel, a senior portfolio manager at Tortoise Capital, adding that under Trump, it's always the weekend. Holiday travelers will stare down an average nationwide gasoline price of $4.08 a gallon and pay airfares that have skyrocketed with energy costs. Benchmark U.S. crude figures vaulted 11% higher Thursday to $111.54 a barrel, while the global Brent crude benchmark rose 7.8%. Thursday's swings in oil prices were the latest in a hair-trigger market in which traders have been glued to any new information, sparking moves with a scant relationship to the underlying disruption to physical supplies. Trump's speech included little that he hadn't already said publicly on social media and elsewhere, but it was enough for traders to furiously bid up the price of near-term deliveries of oil. The key risk is the strait, and the address lacked any clarity or plan on reopening it, and this will keep upward pressure on oil prices, according to Oxford Economics, which kept its forecast for oil prices in the second quarter unchanged. Benchmark 10-year yields fell slightly to about 4.312%. On the eve of the war, they were just below 4%. Concerns that higher oil prices will drive up prices, leading to more hawkish stance by central banks, also spurred gold futures to drop an additional 2.75% on Thursday, despite closing the week up and ending a four-week losing streak. That was investors' waver after Trump's speech, ending two-day rally. Next, Trump to impose tariffs as high as 100% on branded drug imports, by Gavin Bade and Xavier Martinez. The U.S. will impose tariffs of up to 100% on branded pharmaceuticals, the White House said Thursday, though nations or drug makers that strike deals with the Trump administration or commit to build manufacturing facilities in the U.S. can receive lower levies. The 100% tariff will apply to patented imported pharmaceuticals from companies that haven't committed to invest in the U.S. and haven't entered into most favored nation agreements to match their U.S. prices to the lowest they charge in other developed countries, a senior administration official said on Thursday. But the full 100% tariff might apply to only a few drug makers or none at all. If a company pledges to invest in U.S. drug manufacturing in the coming years, its tariff rate will fall to 20%, the senior administration official said. The company would have to complete the factory by the end of President Trump's term in the White House, the official said, or tariffs could be increased. Additionally, if a company that has made a U.S. manufacturing pledge also strikes a most favored nation agreement with the Trump administration, its tariffs can fall to zero, the official said. The tariffs will take effect in 120 days, the official said, during which time large pharmaceutical companies can commit to invest in the U.S. or make most favored nation deals. Smaller companies will be given 180 days to make investment commitments. Most favored nation deals have been announced by all but one of the 17 major drug makers the administration sent letters to last summer demanding lower prices. And the senior administration official said he didn't anticipate that any drug maker would ultimately face the 100% tariff. Regeneron, the lone holdout, expects to announce a most favored nation deal soon and anticipates that it will be exempt from the tariffs, according to a spokeswoman for the company. Outside of the manufacturing commitments and the MFN deals, some nations will receive lower pharmaceutical tariff rates based on previous trade agreements their government struck with the U.S. The European Union, Japan, South Korea, and Switzerland will be subject to 15% tariffs on their pharmaceuticals, while the UK's will be 10%. Companies from those nations can also lower their tariffs to zero with domestic manufacturing commitments. On Thursday, the UK government said its pharmaceutical companies wouldn't be tariffed, an assertion the Trump official confirmed, saying the UK drug makers had already committed to invest in the US. The pharmaceutical tariffs will be imposed under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, which allows the president to levy tariffs to address national security risks. Those are separate from Trump's so-called reciprocal tariffs, which the Supreme Court struck down in February, and the 10% global tariff that Trump imposed to replace the invalidated levies. The announcement concludes months of deliberations in the administration over how to tariff foreign-made medicines with the aim of moving the manufacturing of cutting-edge drugs back to the U.S. Last year, the Wall Street Journal reported that the administration would exclude generic drugs from the pharmaceutical tariffs after months of internal debate, a detail confirmed by the announcement on Thursday. The biotechnology industry's main trade group warned that tariffs would hurt smaller drug developers, which often lack the capital to build dedicated U.S. manufacturing facilities. U.S. biotech companies have been eager to expand investments here at home, but tariffs, along with an uncertain policy environment and efforts to force most favored nation schemes, work directly against that goal, said John Crowley, president of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. That was Trump to impose tariffs as high as 100% on branded drug imports. Next, mortgage rates jumped in week, rising to 6.46%. By Nicole Friedman. Mortgage rates rose to the highest level since September, the fifth straight weekly increase. Average rate on the standard 30-year fixed mortgage climbed to 6.46%, up from 6.38% last week, according to a survey of lenders by mortgage finance firm Freddie Mac. Mortgage rates tend to loosely move with government bond yields. Bond investors have been worried about resurgent inflation because of the war in Iran, which could keep interest rates higher than expected. The jump in mortgage rates is slowing buyer activity at the start of the spring housing market, typically the busiest time of year for home purchases. Mortgage applications for home purchases fell a seasonally adjusted 3% last week compared with the previous week, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. The shocks of the jump in rates and the increase in overall economic uncertainty are likely having an impact on buyer confidence, said MBA chief economist Mike Frantoni. Home touring activity, another early indicator of buyer demand, is trailing behind last week. Weekly average showing activity as of March 30th was up 27% year to date, while in 2025, it rose 37% over the same period, according to Zillow's showing time. That was mortgage rates jumped in week, rising to 6.46%. We move from mortgages to media with this story. OpenAI acquires streaming talk show by Katie Deighton. OpenAI is getting into the business of daily news. The maker of ChatGPT said it has acquired TBPN, an online talk show that aims to compete with Bloomberg and CNBC in the by-minute analysis of technology news and executive interviews. OpenAI declined to disclose the terms of the transaction. While TBPN's audience remains modest, averaging around 70,000 viewers per episode across the various online platforms, the show has become very popular among Silicon Valley power players who consider it more supportive of their industry than traditional news outlets. Chief executives who have appeared on as guests include Meta Platform's Mark Zuckerberg, Microsoft's Satya Nadella, and OpenAI's Sam Altman. The 11-person company, which launched in October of 2024 and began live streaming for 3 hours each weekday in March of 2025, says it is profitable and that it generated about $5 million in revenue from advertising last year. TBPN was on track to make more than $30 million in revenue in 2026, according to the company. OpenAI bought TBPN to encourage constructive conversation around the changes AI creates by helping the show grow, according to a memo sent by Fiji Simo, the OpenAI CEO of Applications. TBPN will report to Chris Lahane, OpenAI's Chief Global Affairs Officer, and will help with company communications and marketing outside of the show. They've helped many brands market online, and because they have a strong pulse on where the industry is going, their comms and marketing ideas have really impressed me, Simo wrote in the memo. But TBPN will remain editorially independent, retaining control over its programming, editorial decisions, guest selection, and production schedule, OpenAI said. Corporate promises of editorial independence have been tested by business interests before. As staff at crypto news site CoinDesk alleged in 2024, when the crypto exchange that owns it ordered an article removed. Whether the new ownership affects how TBPN is perceived among key audiences, including OpenAI rivals, remains to be seen. TBPN under OpenAI will wind down its advertising business, which saw co-founders and hosts John Coogan and Jordy Hayes read commercials aloud, radio host style, and don racing jackets emblazoned with the sponsors' logos. Last September, they hired former Postmates executive Dylan Abruscato to manage commercial partnerships. Coogan and Hayes previously said they weren't building the company for a fundraise or a sale. The team was ultimately won over by the promise of expanding the show's audience as well as scaling its production and capabilities, Abruscato said. Moving from commentary to real impact is how this technology is distributed and understood globally is incredibly important to us, Hayes said in a statement. The news comes days after OpenAI closed the largest funding round in Silicon Valley history, but also in the wake of some blows to its image. Claude maker Anthropic attacked the company's ad test in ChatGPT with a Super Bowl commercial that Altman called funny but deceptive. And Altman last month defended the company's new deal with the Defense Department, announced amid a Pentagon feud with Anthropic, but said it looked opportunistic and sloppy. The company is pursuing a strategy shift to concentrate on serving developers and businesses, recently shutting down its Sora video generation app months after its introduction. News Corp, owner of the Wall Street Journal, has a content licensing partnership with OpenAI. That was OpenAI acquires streaming talk show. Next, we move from AI to aluminum with this story. Aluminum crunch risks worsening, by Bob Tita. Bud Reitenauer has spent 23 years building a business out of aluminum. His company, Reitenauer Trailers, specializes in flatbed truck trailers made entirely out of aluminum. Each trailer uses about 4,500 pounds of the lightweight metal, which is also its biggest cost center. Those costs have gone up over the past year, due to higher U.S. tariffs on imported aluminum and rising global prices for the metal. Now his business faces another unexpected challenge, the war in Iran. Most aluminum shipments from countries that ring the Persian Gulf have been curtailed since the fighting started in late February. About one-fifth of the imported aluminum in the U.S. comes from Gulf countries. Last weekend, Iran drones and missiles struck aluminum plants in Abu Dhabi and Bahrain, damaging two of the region's largest producers. The production outage is expected to ripple through depleted U.S. aluminum stocks in the coming months, further putting pressure on prices, which have already been battered by tariff challenges. Nothing could be worse. Every time we pass on a price increase to our customers, the price of aluminum goes up even more, Reitenauer, the CEO of the Reading PA company, said. Companies that buy aluminum to make everything from soda cans to car hoods have been feeling the pain of more expensive aluminum. At Reitenauer Trailers, rising aluminum prices accounted for nearly all of the 9.5% increase in production costs last year. The company doesn't buy imported aluminum, but the metal is priced globally, so supply threats like the war in Iran are reflected quickly at its U.S. price. A complex price system for aluminum provides domestic buyers with almost no protection from the U.S. tariffs on imported aluminum that have increased from 10% to 25% and then to 50% since the start of President Trump's second term. The Trump administration is preparing to overhaul its tariff scheme for steel and aluminum, the Wall Street Journal reported this week, but the changes aren't expected to affect imported commodity-grade metals. The delivered price of aluminum in the U.S., with assorted charges and the tariff factored in, is $6,100 a metric ton, up 83% from a year ago. The tariff and other costs beside the metal account for about $2,520, according to S&P Global Energy. The all-in price for Western Europe is about $4,160. We've become disadvantaged pretty significantly, said Jeff Lehman, North American president for Norsk Hydro's aluminum extrusion business. He said Hydro is losing orders to competitors outside the U.S. that can pay the tariff and offer lower prices because their aluminum costs less. Awake Window and Door is one client that buys long angled pieces of aluminum from a Hydro plant in Oregon to make frames for large windows and glass walls used in luxury homes. Scott Gates, Awake's CEO, said the company's cost for the aluminum feedstock used by Hydro increased by 70% in the past year. Gates said he'd hoped the tariff on his foreign competitors' windows would give Awake an edge as a domestic company. That's not what happened. The tariffs haven't given us a pricing advantage, said Gates, Awake CEO. Their prices went up, and our prices went up also. Although Trump's tariffs were meant to encourage more domestic production of primary aluminum made in smelters, just a few of those facilities are operating in the U.S. High electricity costs have been driving U.S. smelters out of business for decades. About 70% of the primary aluminum consumed in the U.S. comes from Canada. Stocks of aluminum in the U.S. are estimated at 200,000 metric tons, about 2 weeks' worth of domestic consumption, compared with 4 to 6 weeks usually. Shipments from Canada plunged last summer when producers there were unable to quickly recover the cost of rising tariffs from U.S. buyers through the market-determined delivery fee on aluminum. Because of the high price of aluminum, metal traders and distributors have been reluctant to maintain larger inventories, according to company executives. Some Canadian aluminum was diverted to Europe over the summer, and executives expect pressure from dislocated customers of aluminum from the Middle East to lure metal away from the U.S. market. Meanwhile, domestic aluminum producers like Pittsburgh-based Alcoa have benefited from the higher prices. The company, which operates two smelters in Canada and is a partner in a third, had difficulty recovering tariff expenses for a time last year. But rising prices for aluminum are boosting the margin on its aluminum. Alcoa's adjusted income from its aluminum business rose to $520 million during last year's fourth quarter, from $194 million a year earlier. Alcoa's stock is trading at $71.53 a share, up 35% since the start of the year, and at some of its highest levels in 4 years. The tariffs aren't harmful any longer, Molly Bierman, Alcoa's chief financial officer, told investors recently. That was Aluminum Crunch Risks Worsening. So next, Starbucks expands incentive pay plan for store baristas, by Heather Haddon. Starbucks is adding incentives for baristas to boost their service and sales game. The coffee chain said Thursday that it will expand tipping for U.S. baristas when customers pay with credit or debit cards for mobile orders. Tipping currently is restricted to customers placing in-store and drive-through orders with cash or credit cards, or mobile transaction using Starbucks cards. Tipping will soon be offered when credit cards are used for mobile orders and scanning at the register. The Seattle-based company also plans to provide bonuses to baristas whose stores meet performance goals, including targets for sales, operations, and customer satisfaction. Store baristas and shift supervisors who meet the top level of Starbucks' internal ratings for their location can earn a $300 quarterly bonus, or $1,200 for the full year, the company said. Starbucks said the expanding tipping and new bonuses should increase baristas' compensation by an estimated 5 to 8% on top of their current pay, although that depends partly on how much customers choose to tip. The company aims to introduce the new benefit at its company-owned stores in July. This reward recognizes teams that work together to deliver excellence, Starbucks executives said in a company letter Thursday. The move comes as Starbucks is in the midst of a turnaround of its U.S. business, with Chief Executive Brian Nickel aiming to improve service as a means of increasing sales. It's also a delicate time between the world's largest coffee chain and some of its U.S. baristas. The company has yet to agree to terms of a contract with the Starbucks Workers Union, representing roughly 600 of its 10,000 U.S. stores. Some union-represented cafes shut down or limited service for periods during the winter to protest the lack of progress. Union-represented baristas have been pushing Starbucks to agree to more pay and staffing. Starbucks Workers United and the company last month agreed to return to the bargaining table. Negotiations were expected to start this month, the first direct talks between both sides in more than a year. Starbucks said its baristas currently average $30 an hour in total pay and benefits. The company and union will need to bargain separately over extending the new bonus and tipping benefits to the roughly 5% of U.S. stores represented by Starbucks Workers United, the company said. That was Starbucks expands incentive pay for store baristas. Moving on, trade deficit grew in February amid fluid policy by Matt Grusman. The U.S. trade deficit increased in February, continuing a bumpy stretch for international flows of goods amid fast-changing U.S. policy. February imports were $372.1 billion, up 4.3% from January. U.S. exports in February increased slightly less by 4.2% to $314.8 billion. That yielded a February trade deficit of $57.3 billion, up 4.9% from the January deficit. Analysts polled by the Wall Street Journal were expecting a $62 billion deficit. The deficit of the first 2 months of the year is 55% smaller than the same period in 2025, when firms were rushing to import goods ahead of tariffs. New tariffs rocked American supply chains last year, and U.S. businesses are still facing a fast-changing policy landscape. On February 20th, the Supreme Court overturned what had been a primary leg of President Trump's tariff agenda, broad global duties imposed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Trump responded by enacting new tariffs under a different statute, but one whose authority will expire in July. Previous duties weren't overturned by the court and remain in place. Though trade patterns have shifted more abruptly from month to month amid these rapid rulebook changes, recent trade deficit levels have been consistent with those recorded during much of the Biden administration. That was trade deficit grew in February amid fluid policy. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you miss any part of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, or from our Sun Sounds mobile app, available for both Apple and Android phones. Now, let's go on to our next article. KKR Private Equity Fund attracts record $23 billion by Nicholas G. Miller. KKR raised a record $23 billion for a fund focused on private equity investing in North America, even as the industry faces turmoil. The company said the fund, called NAX4, received support from public and private pension plans, sovereign wealth funds, insurance companies, endowments, and foundations, private wealth platforms, family offices, high net worth individual investors, and other institutional investors. Raising our largest fund in this environment reflects the consistency of our approach and the work our teams are doing inside our portfolio companies every day, said Pete Stavros and Nate Taylor, global heads of private equity at KKR. NAX4 is the largest private equity fund raised that focuses on investing solely in North America, KKR said. The fund, which began fundraising in 2024, intends to support majority-owned companies in implementing broad-based employee ownership programs. The closing brings the total amount of the capital raised across the most recent vintages of KKR's flagship regional funds to $46 billion, the firm said. The fund's closing comes even as private equity endures its worst fundraising environment in nearly a decade. The Wall Street Journal has reported that a lack of liquidity and a glut of fund managers are impeding a fundraising recovery, while firms need to sell their large backlog of portfolio companies before investors commit more capital. Additionally, the strong performance of public markets has made private equity funding more challenging. Private equity firms globally raised $408 billion last year, the lowest annual sum since 2016, according to data tracking firm PitchBook. That was KKR Private Equity Fund attracts record $23 billion. Next, Saks Sets Creditor Deal by Adriano Marchesi. Saks Global Enterprises has secured $500 million in financing from key bondholders to support the luxury retailer's planned emergence from bankruptcy this summer. The company that owns and operates Saks Fifth Avenue said Thursday it had entered into a restructuring support agreement with an ad hoc group of its senior secured bondholders. Saks Global plans to emerge from bankruptcy this summer with a lighter debt load, more liquidity, and a more focused store base, supported by the new $500 million exit financing commitment from its key bondholders. In January, the parent of Saks Fifth Avenue and Neiman Marcus filed for bankruptcy protection only about a year after the $2.7 billion merger between the two retailers amid declining sales and high debt repayment. As part of the bankruptcy restructuring, Saks intends to close 12 Saks Fifth Avenue stores by the end of May. The added closures are on top of an initial plan to close 8 Saks stores following a review in February. Once the closures are complete, Saks will have about 13 stores left nationwide, including its Fifth Avenue flagship in Manhattan, less than half of its store count before filing for bankruptcy. Chief Executive Jeffrey Van Remdonk said Thursday that the company's priority during the restructuring is to rebuild relationship with key brands and improve the selection of products and services across its three banners, Saks Fifth Avenue, Neiman Marcus, and Bergdorf Goodman. Remdonk, former CEO of Neiman Marcus, was chosen to lead the company through bankruptcy, succeeding longtime CEO Mark Metrick, who resigned days after Saks missed a $100 million debt payment. Saks Global said Thursday that it continues constructive engagement with its capital partners and other financial stakeholders on a plan of reorganization and expects to file the plan in the coming weeks. That was Saks Sets Creditor Deal. Next, Publicis will buy WME Sports Unit by Katie Deighton. Publicis Group is acquiring the sports marketing agency 160 over 90 from talent firm WME Group as sports becomes an increasingly essential channel for brands seeking mass reach. The French advertising group will pay more than $500 million for the company, according to people familiar with the transaction, and absorb its 670 employees into a unit called Publicis Sports. WME, which was known as Endeavor until going private last year, bought 160 over 90 in 2018 for about $200 million. The agency is best known for brokering and managing brand sponsorship deals with athletes and sports properties. It also runs corporate hospitality and branded experiences at events such as the Super Bowl and the Olympics. Sports has emerged as one of the few pillars of monoculture still standing while consumers' interests, tastes, and time splinter across an array of media channels. The rise of women's sports has at the same time opened up more sponsorship opportunities to female-focused brands. Ad holding companies have tried to capitalize by forming new teams to help clients navigate the world of media rights, exclusivity deals, athlete contracts, and more. Stagwell in January announced it had spun off its sports beach events business into its own company, while the media buying arm of London-based WPP announced the formulation of WPP Media Sports, a unified data-driven sports marketing practice. Publicis, which owns agencies such as Saatchi & Saatchi and BBH, similarly said it would bring more transparency to the disjointed business of sports marketing, a channel that clients have long complained lacks good data to reliably prove a return on investment. It will pitch advertisers on an all-in-one solution. Publicis will broker sports sponsorship deals, but also make the ads, buy the media, and work with influencers to amplify them and boost up its Epsilon data business to measure and adjust for reach and effectiveness, executives said. Everything in sports is completely disruptive. The growth has been crazy, but yet it's fragmented and the model hasn't changed in 25 to 30 years, said Susie Deering, a former chief marketing officer of Ford and eBay, who was named chief executive of Publicis Sports last October. Robbie Henchman, the president of 160 over 90, will remain at WME Group as a senior partner and president of WME's brand representation business, and oversee a new partnership between WME Group and Publicis Group. The arrangement will give the advertising giant access to WME's talent and intellectual property roster, and WME access to some of the world's largest brands. WME represents stars including figure skating gold medalist Elisa Liu, tennis champion Carlos Alcaraz, actors Teyana Taylor and Michael B. Jordan. Publicis clients include top ad spenders such as McDonald's and Coca-Cola. That was Publicis will buy WME Sports Unit. Next, we move from advertising to automotives with this article, Tesla's deliveries rise but still trail forecasts, by Becky Peterson. After a year marked by sluggish electric vehicle sales, Tesla's deliveries rose 6.3% in the first quarter from a year earlier, but that result still missed Wall Street expectations. Tesla's final quarterly tally was 358,023 EVs delivered globally. Analysts had been expecting 368,900 deliveries, according to a consensus of 19 investment firms' estimates published by Visible Alpha. Tesla's stock dropped 5.4% to $360.59 on Thursday. Despite the growth from a year-ago quarter, it was Tesla's second-worst quarter of sales since 2022. Still, the results signal a stabilization of its auto sales after sales fell sharply last year amid backlash against chief executive Elon Musk's political activism. The company has struggled over the past 2 years to keep up with competition from Chinese automakers. Other U.S. manufacturers have also cut back on investments in their electric vehicle lineups in response to shifting policies under the Trump administration and lukewarm interest in green vehicles from car buyers. General Motors and Ford Motor reported significant declines in U.S. sales for the first quarter across all vehicle types. One bright spot, Rivian reported the delivery of 10,365 vehicles in the first quarter, up 30% from 8,000 a year earlier. Its stock rose 3.1% on the news. The growth in deliveries comes as Tesla pivots its business from vehicle sales to focus on robo-taxis and humanoid robots, neither of which is currently for sale. Vehicle sales accounted for around 3/4 of Tesla's revenue in 2025 and declined for the second year in a row. The company is winding down production of its two luxury models, the Model S and Model X, and plans to start mass production of its autonomous Cybercab this month. Tesla also reported a 15% decline in its energy business, a figure that measures how much battery energy the company deployed in the first quarter. Energy deployments grew rapidly last year, even as its auto business slowed. Tesla will report its full quarter earnings on April 22nd. In January, Tesla announced it would end production on the Model S and Model X, its low-volume luxury models, which it sells for around $100,000. That brings down Tesla's EV lineup to three models, the popular Model 3 and Model Y, and its low-volume stainless steel Cybertruck pickup. The company also is working on a new version of its Roadster sports car, though it is unclear when that will be available for sale following almost a decade of delays. Most of the company's focus is on its strategic pivot for its next phase of growth that it's calling Amazing Abundance, an edit to its previously announced tagline of Sustainable Abundance. In a master plan released last summer, the company laid out a high-level vision in which artificial intelligence, robotics, and energy storage systems eliminate scarcity. This month, the company is scheduled to start mass production on the Cybercab, a dedicated robo-taxi. Musk has said Tesla will sell the Cybercab to customers for under $30,000 by the end of the year, though analysts have questioned the timeline. Some analysts expect Tesla to use most of the Cybercabs produced in the next term for its robo-taxi rideshare app, which has limited operations in Texas and California. In November, shareholders approved a new pay package for Musk, which could make him the world's first trillionaire if he succeeds in increasing Tesla's market cap to $8.5 trillion while hitting a series of financial and operational goals, including selling more vehicles. That was Tesla's deliveries rise, but still trail forecasts. Next up, Amazon to apply fuel surcharge of 3.5% to third-party sellers, by Esther Fung. Amazon.com is imposing a 3.5% fuel surcharge on independent merchants that sell on its platform later this month, a move that could translate to higher prices for consumers. The temporary fee goes into effect April 17th for many of the sellers who use Amazon's warehouses and delivery services to store inventory and ship orders. The e-commerce giant is the latest company to apply extra fees to offset rising energy costs as the Iran war enters its second month. Amazon said that until now it had absorbed the higher fuel and logistics cost. But similar to other major carriers, when costs remain elevated, we implement temporary surcharges to partially recover those costs, a company spokeswoman said. United Parcel Service and FedEx have also recently raised fuel surcharges to reflect rising oil prices. And last week, the U.S. Postal Service announced its first ever fuel and transportation surcharge, an 8% fee that is planned to apply to packages shipped between April 26th to January 17th. As of April 17th, Amazon's fuel and logistics-related surcharge will apply to U.S. and Canadian sellers using its Fulfillment by Amazon option. Sellers using the Buy with Prime and multi-channel fulfillment options will see the surcharge starting May 2nd. Amazon, which hosts about 2 million sellers on its platform worldwide, said its surcharge is meaningfully lower than other major carriers and would be based on the fulfillment fees it charges third-party merchants, not on the sale price of items. FedEx and UPS updated their fuel surcharges weekly based on prices established by the U.S. Department of Energy. On average, the surcharge amounts to an extra 17 cents per unit for sellers using the Fulfillment by Amazon option, and varies based on the item's dimensions, the company said. How much those costs are then passed on to consumers is up to the sellers. Amazon didn't provide a time frame for when the fuel surcharge would end. That was Amazon to apply fuel surcharge of 3.5% to third-party sellers. In a related article, U.S. oil prices post biggest daily gain in years, by Ryan Dezember. U.S. oil futures notched their biggest daily gain since they were climbing back from the COVID crash 6 years ago to close out a whiplash holiday-shortened week at $111.54 a barrel. Benchmark U.S. oil futures are now up 66% since the U.S. and Israel began bombing Iran at the end of February. In dollar terms, prices in March rose $43.96 a barrel, more than in any other month since West Texas Intermediate crude futures began trading in 1983. In two trading sessions so far in April, they've added an additional $10.16 a barrel. Energy futures trading is closed for Good Friday, along with the stock market. Futures will resume trading at 6 p.m. on Sunday. Brent oil futures, the global benchmark, settled Thursday at $109.03 a barrel, below the level of the U.S. benchmark, a rare occurrence. Oil executives and analysts say that the futures prices need to climb further before they reflect how expensive actual barrels of crude have become. Some spot market prices around the world are at their highest since 2008, when U.S. futures hit their record of $145.29. That would be around $215 a barrel in today's dollars. Prices had fallen during the two trading sessions leading up to President Trump's primetime address on Wednesday night, when he dashed the hopes for a prompt end to the Iran war that had been coursing through markets. Trump vowed to hit Iran extremely hard in the coming weeks and pummel the country, quote, back to the Stone Ages where they belong. Thursday's $11.42 a barrel climb in the U.S. benchmark was only the third time prompt month oil futures have ever added more than $10 or more in a single session. That was U.S. oil prices post biggest daily gains in years. Next, U.S. jobless claims fall unexpectedly, by Ed Frankel. U.S. jobless claims declined last week with little sign so far that the rise in global energy prices prompted by the conflict in the Middle East is scaring employment. The number of people who filed for unemployment benefits was 202,000 in the week through March 28, down 9,000 from the previous week's upward revised level of 211,000, the Labor Department said Thursday. Economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal were expecting to see a higher 212,000 new claims. That was U.S. jobless claims fall unexpectedly. So next, let's turn to the opinion section of the journal and begin with this Review and Outlook article, Trump's Breakthrough Defense Budget. Washington has, for years, given priority to spending on butter over guns. The result is a shrunken military-industrial base that's been exposed by the wars in Iran and Ukraine. Credit, then, to President Trump, who is meeting the moment by proposing a new and record increase in national defense. The White House releases its fiscal year 2027 budget on Friday, and we got an early look. Most noteworthy is its proposal to boost defense spending to $1.5 trillion. This includes a $250 billion increase in the annual defense baseline from $903 billion, plus $350 billion in supplemental funding that Republicans could pass in a party-line budget reconciliation bill. Defense spending in 2027 would be roughly what it was in 2021 and more than 40% higher than this year, including supplemental $155 billion that Congress provided in last summer's bill. Defense spending has fallen to 3% as a share of GDP, compared to some 6% in the 1980s and 8% in the 1960s. The White House budget would increase this to 4.5%, which is close to the 5% goal that the president has set for NATO members. The rub will be sustaining this defense commitment as entitlements grow on autopilot and grab an ever larger budget share. Spending on defense made up about 13% of total federal outlays in 2025, half as much as the 1980s and 70% less than in the 1960s. Joe Biden sought to continue this declinist trajectory with a 2025 budget that proposed $9.7 trillion in defense spending and $10.4 trillion in non-defense spending over 10 years. The Trump budget shifts the government's priorities in the right direction with $13.5 trillion in defense and $6 trillion in non-defense spending over the next decade. The budget includes $65.8 billion to buy 18 naval warships and 16 non-battle force vessels. The Office of Management and Budget says the administration has requested funding for 123 vessels for all agencies, including the Coast Guard, across its two budgets and the supplemental funding bill, which is the largest shipbuilding order since World War II. This is needed as the current fleet is working overtime and is too small to meet America's far-flung obligations. The U.S. in recent years has retired more warships than it has commissioned. Many older ships can't be deployed because they need repairs. This means vessels are doing double duty with increasing risk of breakdown. A fire broke out last month on the aircraft carrier USS Gerald R. Ford, which has been sailing around the world for nearly 10 months, a near-record deployment. For those that are not in the Navy, that's an extraordinary thing to even think about, something of that kind of deployment length, Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Darrell Caudle said this week. The new Trump proposal also aims to expand the military-industrial base so that the U.S. won't have to worry about being short of munitions or manpower. This includes long-term contracts to replenish munitions stocks so defense contractors can invest in production lines with more certainty. The budget recommends a 5% to 7% pay increase for military personnel next year, and it includes critical investment in the Golden Dome missile defense system, the sixth-generation F-47 stealth fighter program, new drone models, cruise missiles, and long-range fires crucial to defending Taiwan. Congress will get the say over how much of this becomes law, and Mr. Trump will have to keep the political pressure on. Deficit goals will say it's unaffordable, but there are savings to be had by cutting fraud in Medicaid and other welfare programs. Investing in military deterrence is also far cheaper than having to fight a war against China. Mr. Trump likes to say no military can match America's, yet it isn't nearly as dominant as it once was, even as the world grows more dangerous. The president's budget shows a welcome new realism about the multiplying threats America faces. That was Trump's breakthrough defense budget. And finally, this opinion article. Why Britain Can't Afford a Navy. If you're wondering why the United Kingdom apparently can't afford a navy anymore, ask Nigel Farage. The insurgent politician who leads a party called Reform UK, ostensibly committed to making Britain great again. On Thursday, he promised voters more social welfare. Mr. Farage pledged that if his party ever wins power, it will keep something called the triple lock on benefits as part of the British equivalent to America's Social Security program for the elderly. Under this policy, a retiree's state pension payout rises by the highest of the average wage growth, inflation, or 2.5% every year. Introduced in 2011, when the Conservative Party was in power, the triple lock has caused a significant increase in benefits per retiree, even as an aging population swells the ranks of claimants. By one count, the triple lock cost about £12 billion more per year than if payouts had increased solely in line with average earnings. For comparison, annual defense spending is only some £66 billion. The triple lock creates a big but unpredictable ratchet for the government's social spending bill. No one can guess over time how fast old age social spending will grow. Mr. Farage, who at other times presents himself as something of a free marketeer, presumably is smart enough to understand Britain can't afford this. He claimed Thursday that his party will soon unveil a raft of welfare reforms to cut spending on other programs to free up resources for the old age payout. Good luck on that. The old age giveaway is an attempt to woo voters away from the center-left Labour Party ahead of local elections across the country in May. Reform UK appears to be gambling that it can win over large parts of Labour's old electoral base by combining immigration restrictionism with statist economics. But how Mr. Farage thinks this could translate into a political coalition in favour of broad welfare reforms is a mystery. Labour Prime Minister Keir Starmer last year briefly tried to reform a different disability welfare program to free up money for defense. He failed amid opposition from all sides. Now the party with reform in its name is also taking major entitlement reform off the table. This kind of welfare recklessness has consequences, and in Britain an embarrassing one is the decline of the military. London's struggle to deploy the Navy to the Mediterranean to defend British assets during the Iran War, let alone help to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, exposes the national security price Britain is paying for social handouts. It's a recipe for continuing British decline. That was Why Britain Can't Afford a Navy. And that brings us to the end of today's Wall Street Journal for Friday, April 3rd, 2026. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.